for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Panic strikes Asian and European markets, and the IMF says the world is on the cusp of recession. NATO agrees to NATO agrees to attack the drug trade in Afghanistan amid fears the war will get worse and may be unwinnable. And Pakistan says the U.S. is helping terrorists with its missile attacks there. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Roy Gutman of McClatchy Newspapers, Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times, and Scott Wilson of the Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Well, what a day, gentlemen. Thanks for being here. Daniel Dombey, what are the international markets doing today?
Well, you can see that there is enormous fear and concern. One doesn't know how far this process is going to work itself out. But I think at the root of the falls that we've seen on Wall Street and elsewhere is the worrying fear that at the moment the world's international leaders don't really have the answer. They've tried a number of times in recent days. We saw the coordinated interest rate cut earlier this week, something that even China chimed in with. So it was the kind of act of unity you only see a couple of times a decade. So I think the last previous time was September the 11th. We've seen efforts by individual governments, by the US, by the UK, by Europe. So far, the markets aren't convinced.
And Scott Wilson, this meeting this weekend at the G7, the meeting with leaders at the White House, can something new come out of this?
Well, I think expectations are not very high that something new will come out. There has been quite a bit of coordination, improvisational at times, but it has been pretty surprising in ways. EU leaders have overcome some of their built-in tensions into that organization has to come together. The European Central Bank, the Bank of England, everyone has come together to cut rates. But you know, right now, as President Bush said this morning, a lot of this right now is trying to calm nerves and calm perceptions, and whether they can come out with some kind of new package, a rescue package that EU leaders have resisted in the past is unclear, and I think expectations are low that will happen.
Isn't that the problem here, or at least one of the major parts of the problem, that the EU itself cannot agree on a single approach? Roy Gutman.
Well, they're slow off the mark. They had an opportunity about a week ago, and they didn't take it. The French had floated a plan. The Germans shot it down. And there was backbiting afterwards. The British went their own way. It looked like unilateral approaches were going to dominate. I think that after this last week, it's been so sobering and so scaring, this panic that's emerged, that they're going to have to get their act together, but they still don't have it.
This morning on NPR, Alastair Darling said the mood is changing and that governments realize this is a global problem and they understand they need to act. Daniel?
Well, they understand that they need to act. They don't necessarily understand yet on a substantive way in which to pool their efforts. Just to repeat what my colleagues have said, that European Union meeting last weekend was terrible because the worst thing you can do is set out your goal of reaching a combined joint stance and then fail to reach it. But this isn't just this financial crisis. On issue after issue, one of the problems that Europe faces is that they realise that on individual issues, on the issues that most matter in the world, single countries don't make enough of a difference, but they all want to make up their own mind. So whether it's an issue like Russia or whether it's an issue like the financial crisis, each country wants to do its own thing by its own population. And in situations like this, that can lead to devastating effect. That isn't just a case problem for the EU, it's a problem for the world as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think some of the unified response that we have seen from European leaders of late, what there has been, was a sense essentially forced by Ireland starting off right away by guaranteeing bank deposits, which angered many other countries, and suddenly everyone's reacting in their own piecemeal way, and then suddenly there's a unified rate cut. But it feels very improvisational at times, and there are these barriers that are going to be hard to surmount.
What about the IMF offering this bleak forecast for the world economy?
It's a way to prompt governments to action, but some of the built-in barriers and sense of sovereignty that a lot of these joint groups have are really being tested right now in responding individually.
Yeah, one of the things the IMF says is that it says that it's actually been one of the more hawkish, alarmed spectators of this whole phenomenon for some time now. Now, they say that actually if the world's leaders do pool efforts, we could see a recovery sometime towards the end of next year. But that requires a lot of steps which people haven't taken so far. It's going to be interesting to see whether, for example, the British model of trying to put money directly into banks and taking stakes in those banks, rather than this US model of buying paper of questionable worth, is going to be something that people unite around. There have been indications that the US is thinking more in those directions.
Wasn't it a British newspaper that had the headline, "We're all socialists now," Roy?
Well, in fact, socialism is a pretty dirty word on the whole in this country, and yet the government buying into major banking houses, AIG and now if possibly banks, suggests that at least it's going to be a temporary phenomenon. I was going to say one of the things is that's so fascinating right now is that the European Union really is not set up to deal with the crisis, and I'm not sure quite how it could be with the various sovereign states in it. Whereas the United States, for all of its problems, and in a sense we are the origin of this whole thing through our deregulation here, is much more able to manage in crisis. The Europeans have got to figure out some kind of a mechanism. They don't have it yet. Crisis sometimes will bring it out, or it could also, because the euro depends on it. The euro is this common currency, but they don't have the ability basically to defend it or to defend their markets.
And I think one of the other interesting things to expand on that is if you look at some of the individual bank rescue plans that Europe has undertaken, whether it's Fortis or Dexia, these are banks that really do span national borders there. Many of the countries don't have the reserves to defend them themselves. And so Luxembourg and France and Belgium have come together on a piecemeal basis to rescue giant institutions that there really is no single country that can save them or is willing to save them on their own. So
I would just say that one of the problems complicating this is that the euro is a bit of a Trojan horse. The euro was specifically designed to be a halfway house in which if you had monetary union, the pressure for greater political union, for greater coordination on other financial issues would be too great, precisely because you need to unify financial and fiscal policy if you've got a common currency. The problem is that there wasn't the political will for that greater integration, so we're trapped.
Let's talk for a moment about what's happened in Iceland, because that looks pretty serious. Their entire financial system collapsed yesterday.
Yeah, the government is now has control of the three largest banks in Iceland. 80,000 of Iceland's 310,000 people now hold bank stock that's worthless. It's a place that's the first real example of a national casualty of this crisis.
So what does it mean when a country collapses financially?
Well, there are very many examples that one has in the past. Argentina was a country that went essentially bankrupt early this decade. Mexico had a similar crisis 14 years ago. Two things about Iceland is, one is that although it's one of the richest countries in the world, its economy is very like an emerging market because it has very high interest rates. It's been keeping its currency very high. It's dependent on imports. And so it's basically become a hedge fund that issues passports. People have saved money in Iceland, borrowed it elsewhere. Lots of Icelandic natives were borrowing mortgages in yen, in euros and so on. It was one big carry trade, and that's always a risky business.
So what happens next for Iceland, Roy?
Well, right now, Iceland and the UK and Britain are in a kind of war of words because each has frozen the accounts of the other side. Somebody's got to come to Iceland's rescue. The Russians have already agreed, I gather, to a $4 or $5 billion loan. But it's
and
kind of
what about the IMF? Isn't Iceland going to the IMF?
Well, that would certainly be the logical step. And the United States, I mean, Iceland is a part of NATO. You would think that its NATO partners would be the first to come to its rescue rather than Russia. It's an amazing spectacle.
It is. I mean, I was just going to point out the idea of Russia bailing out Iceland, a NATO country, is remarkable and really shows all the the different links that this crisis has now. Britain and Iceland in this kind of cold war over bank accounts. Britain having to guarantee all British depositors who have accounts in Iceland. The tentacles are just spreading everywhere.
I just wanted to make two points about that. One is that this was an enormously big phenomenon in the UK. You had lots of ordinary savers, you had lots of local councils that thought they were on a one-way ticket to success by saving money in these Icelandic banks. And there were notices on the British Financial Services Authority website saying these accounts were guaranteed, but it was never clear by whom. The other issue is just the wonderful issue about the Russia story, or the astonishing issue about the Russia story. The point about Iceland is that it's not just a NATO country. It's been a Cold War. It was a Cold War haven full of spies. And it was a Vienna of the North, and we're seeing that side again.
Daniel Dumpy, he's U.S. diplomatic correspondent for the Financial Times. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, this week with Scott Wilson of the Washington Post, Daniel Dumby of the Financial Times, Roy Gutman of McClatchy Newspapers. Here's an email which says, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown issued some very stark warnings to Iceland regarding, I think, its balance of payment. Is there a potential this financial crisis could escalate to a military crisis? Daniel.
Not in that sense. I mean, we've traded a few shots with the Icelandic fishing fleet in 30 years ago in the famous Cod Wars. But despite the frosty relationship right now, no one's expecting anything like that. I would say, however, there is one other thing that is really worth bearing in mind. This financial crisis is not just confined to the rich world. It is going to be something that is going to have a very severe effect on some of the weakest, most unstable countries in the world. We're seeing Pakistan asking for Iran to give it oil and pay it later. It's going to have a knock-on effect throughout the world, so there could be military impacts.
And here's an email to that very point. Which countries are financially solvent today? Which countries have a surplus? Where are we looking for the loan for the rescue plan monies? Scott.
some of the oil-rich countries have cash and sovereign wealth funds that have not been doing well these last couple of weeks. But there is some cushion in some of those places. At the same time, many of them build their budgets around oil at very low prices to start the year and accumulate large surpluses. But we're seeing oil dip very low now. It's near $80 a barrel, I believe. So they will be suffering, you know, they will be restrained in the future with what they have. But some of those cash-rich countries are okay at the moment.
Well, of course, China has an enormous amount of wealth that the government has control over. It hasn't actually acted in any way yet, but it might. The other country that has a fair amount of in its balance of payments on a positive side is Russia. But Russia has gone through an enormous gyration in its stock market. In fact, it's closed down repeatedly. Their stocks have gone down as much as 60 or 70%, and that was earlier this week. So everybody is now on the outside just watching, I think, before they throw money into what looks like a sinking enterprise.
All right, let's turn to Afghanistan. The White House has fast-tracked a new national intelligence estimate on Afghanistan. What's in that draft document, Daniel?
I haven't seen the draft document myself, but reports have indicated that document says that if the situation there is spiraling out of control. Now, that is very interesting because we have two things going on at once. On the one hand, we have a US call for Europeans to send more troops there. On the other hand, we have greater doubts than ever before about the strategy and whether the US and its allies can win a war against the Taliban. It's rather difficult to have both those things going on at the same time.
Absolutely. I mean, we've had the British commander in Afghanistan say that the war really appears to be unwinnable militarily. The British ambassador saying that the presence of foreign troops may be doing more harm than good. This was an argument that was made in Iraq at one point as well, but the situation on the ground is very different. The geography is very different. General McKiernan, the U.S. commander in Iraq, has said that the surge, as it was conceived of in Iraq, will not work, will not translate into Afghanistan. So absolutely, we're asking for more troops at a time when many people are doubting whether troops are the answer.
Well, the other interesting thing is that Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, himself, I think, sounded the first alarm in a very serious way. And that was on September 11th, when he was testifying in Congress. And he said, we are going to have a strategy that takes in not only Afghanistan, but also Pakistan and the tribal areas. And one of our reporters at McClatchy went around the Pentagon just to find out, well, what was the previous strategy that this is going to supplant? And it turns out there was none. They really haven't had a plan for the use of force these past 7 years. It's an astonishing thing. And so the fact that they're now urgently trying to organize one just shows how far behind the eight ball we are.
So is this administration likely to undertake a new strategy prior to a new president coming in?
There's no way it can. Time is so limited right now. But they can at least try to have the major elements in place. These national intelligence estimates that are being done for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq are part of the laying the groundwork for what will be a strategy. But a real strategy is going to take months and months to work out and then years and years to carry out.
Daniel.
Yes, I think I just really would like to back up that point. One of the most important things the new president is going to be doing next year, no matter whether it's Obama or McCain, is attending a NATO summit in April in Europe, where he's going to be asking for more European troops. That's going to be a big moment. There has to be a bit more of a coherent strategy in place by that time. It is truly astonishing that there hasn't been a coherent strategy for the 7 years that we've had since September the 11th. People have confused having a just war, a casus belli, with having an achievable goal. It can be a just war and you can not have an achievable goal.
Interesting that the Sunday Times of London quoted Britain's commander in Afghanistan, Brigadier Mark Carleton Smith, as saying, quote, we're not going to win this war. It's about reducing it to a manageable level of insurgency that's not a strategic threat and can be managed by the Afghan army. Sounds as though we're ready to turn it over.
Well, many people have fought wars in Afghanistan. Very few have won. The Brits have lost their fair share of wars in Afghanistan. The one time they did emerge with something like success was when they did local deals with local warlords. There's a balance there between people who say you need to send more troops and people who say you need to talk to Taliban. And even Secretary Gates is now saying that's something you can contemplate.
And I think one of the strong points emerging from the National Intelligence Estimate is the fact that the Karzai government, which has really been supported by the Bush administration, is now being blamed for quite a bit of what's happening, the deep-seated corruption that's inside this government. And so it really is not only militarily but politically a situation that's very much degenerating. And at a time when Pakistan and Afghanistan are really beginning to see their war as one war, as it's overlapping in the tribal areas.
Is the Pakistani government on the right track to contain that extremist threat, Scott?
It's impossible to know what they're going to be able to do in the havens, in the tribal areas that the National Intelligence Estimate is saying, you know, increasingly sophisticated attacks into Afghanistan are being staged there. There is now, we reported in today's paper, this new national campaign, advertising campaign that's very unusual in Pakistan, using celebrities and singers to try to make the point that Pakistan now owns this war, that this is a war that Pakistan is now involved in on its own terms. And so there is a new sense of urgency there, but still a government that seems very unsure about how to engage the Pakistan Taliban in the tribal areas.
Roy.
They've done something very original this week by asking the military high command to brief the parliament in a secret session. It was the beginning of an attempt to actually take control over the military by the civilian government, and certainly as a novelty and as an advance, it's worth noting. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to have had the effect it was intended to, because the politicians there are divided, as always. And meanwhile, the army has actually taken on some new, a much more aggressive approach in some of the areas like Bajaur. They have been on the attack. They've been trying to, but not just on their own, they're trying to organize lashkars, these tribal militias, to go after the homegrown Taliban as well as the outside Taliban. And but, of course, the other side has its means as well. And there was a suicide bombing today where dozens of people were killed.
And yesterday, Daniel, Pakistan said that U.S. missile attacks are actually helping the terrorists.
Well, there is this argument that you are not helping hearts and minds at all by attacking sites in Pakistan. You're making the issue a more difficult one to portray as Pakistan's war if the US carries out unilateral acts without Pakistani permission. And I would also just say, just following the previous points, we are in 2008. It is truly astonishing that this effort to depict this as Pakistan's war, this effort to sell the war against Taliban, is taking place in 2008.
One thing I wanted to mention is that in Admiral Mullins' testimony last month, he said that from now on the U.S. would listen more to President Karzai and to the government there in deciding which local warlords or which local powers it was going to work with. The implication is, and it's actually absolutely true, that the U.S. has been picking its local allies rather than depending on the central government. So the central government has been weakened in Afghanistan over the years by virtue of American policy and American actions. Now, the reversal is really, it's not just long overdue, it may be too late.
Roy Gutman of McClatchy News, and if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Paul in Oklahoma says, please discuss the drone attacks on Pakistan. They seem to be coming every few days. In this atmosphere of U.S. elections and a worldwide economic crisis, I feel they're being ignored. Daniel?
Well, I wouldn't say they're necessarily being ignored. I mean, this, after all, is one of the big points of contention between Senator Obama and Senator McCain, this idea that if Pakistan is unwilling to attack, to act, the U.S. will. It's certainly true, however, that it is not necessarily a fully-fledged strategy to send out drone attacks to specific targets in areas where you have very few other options.
Let's talk about the federal judge this week releasing or ordering the government to release some Guantanamo prisoners. Scott, these are the so-called Uyghurs, the Chinese Muslims. Why did this happen?
Well, it's the first time it has happened, which is what's most significant. And the judge's ruling, the opinion was quite sweeping, saying that it's not constitutional to hold people without cause, and they were not showing cause. The Uyghurs are a particular case. They are not threats, seen as threats to the United States. And there had been for months a sense that they would be released very soon and were supposed to be. But there is also fear within the White House and the Justice Department that this could set a precedent for the other 260 or so people being held at Guantanamo Bay.
So they're going to fight the ruling.
And the Justice Department has filed an emergency appeal. It's been stayed. And so, as a precedent, I think, is what's most important. The Uyghurs themselves, in fact, they're going to be coming to the Washington area to resettle. The United States does not feel they can be sent back to China for fear of persecution. Their case is specific, but the ruling could have wider implications.
Could this go to the Supreme Court?
I would imagine it's quite likely if the debate remains this way.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Roy, you want to add something?
Yes, what we're seeing playing out this week in Washington is just a sneak preview of what's going to happen after the elections. The Bush administration, as we know, has said it wanted to close down Guantanamo, but really never came up with a plan for doing it, and the Uyghurs are the best evidence. The fact is Obama and McCain, I think, are going to be more determined, but the likely outcome is going to be that where are these people going to go other than the United States? They're probably going to come here eventually, but the Bush administration is going to fight till the ends of time, and the ends of time are very soon.
Daniel.
Yeah, I would just follow up on that. I mean, the problem with the U.S. case is if you're trying to convince other countries that it's safe to take people from Guantanamo who have been absolved of any kind of crime or who have not been charged or convicted of any kind of crime, it's rather important to show by example. The other point is that why many of these people may come to the U.S. is that over a third of the people in Guantanamo are from Yemen, and the U.S. has very, very severe concerns about whether people in Yemen are detained effectively, are stopped from rejoining terrorist groups, and so on. Again, that's something that may mean that those people come here, not perhaps to be free, but detained in some other way.
But they've never had a case against these people. They've had they've brought no charges. They are not criminals. At least they have not been labeled criminals. So what choice do you have under any international legal system other than to release them?
And where are we now with negotiators in terms of U.S. deployment from Iraq? Daniel.
We are in, I think, to be honest, the realm of the surreal. You have a Bush administration 3 weeks before the next election and the next president is chosen, still insisting that it's going to negotiate not just an agreement that will change the UN mandate to a US mandate for the US troops' presence in Iraq, but a long-term agreement setting out a goal for when they might begin to draw down, setting out the rules of the game going ahead. I have to say, it looked a bit of a push in July when they wanted to conclude it. Right now, it just seems bizarre.
Scott.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, in 3 weeks, you're going to have an authentically lame duck administration still pushing a very far-reaching agreement with Iraq. And Iraqi politicians are going to be wise to be skeptical about what they're signing on to when a new administration takes office in January. And this week we heard again that, tough decisions and sacrifices are going to have to be made by Iraqi lawmakers to approve this deal. But it's hard to know what's in it for them at this point.
And the Washington Times is reporting today that Barack Obama tried to convince Iraqis to delay finalizing the deal until next year after a new president takes office. What can you tell us about that, Daniel?
Well, I would just say it's a very interesting story, but the lead of a story is different from the most interesting part of a story. The lead of a story is that Mr. Obama was trying to convince Iraqi leaders that the president shouldn't be allowed to carry out this deal without congressional approval. Now, that has been the standard Democratic position for almost a year. It seems strange that this agreement would be ratified by the Iraqi parliament, but the U.S. Congress would not be formally requested to approve it.
Roy. However,
The story itself has some weaknesses, and the ambassador is quoted as saying that basically the agreement should be postponed, but that's not actually followed up in the story itself. So there's some issues with the story. The interesting thing, of course, about right now is it's not that just the United States that has an election. The Iraqis themselves have finally organized to have their own provincial elections in January, or it could be a little bit after that, which is a huge milestone for them. And this is an issue for Iraqis. The second element of the Iraqi equation is that their neighbor, Iran, has said in no uncertain terms that they really want no privileges for the Americans. They want to see the Americans go. So the Iraqi government has a lot of pressures of its own, whatever Barack Obama may have said to them.
Roy Gutman, he's foreign editor of McClatchy Newspapers. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm. More information at conversation.wamu.org. And by the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer and comedian Louis C.K. He's been a writer for David Letterman, Conan O'Brien, and Chris Rock, and was the star and creator of the HBO series Lucky Louie. He's currently on tour, and his new special, Chewed Up, is on Showtime this month. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And it's time to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Durham, New Hampshire. Hi there, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to touch on the financial crisis of the world right now again. Last week, 60 Minutes, Steve Croft did quite a piece on something called a credit default swap and said that the world of financial markets and banks have lost a cumulative $60 trillion. And it doesn't seem like $700 billion for a bailout or anything else that's being proposed is going to cover that. I'd just like to know a little bit more about a credit default swap, if any of your guests can help me with
that. Sure. Scott.
Well, I'll give it a shot, but I think essentially the point was that there's $60 trillion in sort of a shadow of shadow guarantees out there, guaranteeing debt that could potentially go bad. The credit default swap was an instrument used. They didn't call it insurance because insurance would have to be regulated. It would have to be overseen by the government. And so they called it this credit default swap, which was guaranteeing the mortgage-backed securities. And so you're essentially guaranteeing something that's going bad. And that's where that problem comes in. And you have trillions of dollars of this stuff in outstanding guarantees. Now, they may not be worth the paper they're written on, since the securities themselves aren't. They weren't formal insurance policies. It's hard to it's complicated, but it is a very big problem.
Are we likely to see new regulation worldwide if this economic crisis ever comes to an end? Daniel?
Are we likely to see new regulation worldwide? I think we're likely to see new regulation across the world. I'm still not sure about whether you can
act in a global concert way
to set out lasting rules. I think there are so many pressures.
But don't we need those actions in concert if indeed we are one globe in our financial dealings?
I'm just going to come up with an answer which people may think is completely out of date following the events of the last few weeks and far too British. I think the nation state is still quite relevant for a lot of people. And when you talk about fiscal policy, when you talk about financial policy, that goes to the heart of what being a nation state is about in many ways.
All right. To Mike in St. Louis, Missouri, good morning to you.
Hi, Diane.
Hi
great
there.
Discussion.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add or talk about capitalism. There's been a lot of, and we were just talking about just now, about new regulations. And the real problem is not regulations per se or deregulation, but what we have done is really re-regulated. We didn't create a level playing field for everyone. We made special regulations as we went along for certain instances. And that just exacerbated the whole problem of what I call sort of our oligarchical capitalism and partial socialism. The real capitalism now is demonstrating to the world that it doesn't buy all the verbal attempts to assuage the markets. I mean, the reality is that the world is not, the world capital markets are not buying the story anymore, and true capitalism works. And it's really what made us great. Since the Depression, we have overregulated, and that sounds kind of, people are constantly talking about how we deregulated. We didn't deregulate, we re-regulated, and it's like taking a three-legged chair and cutting two of the legs off and saying that we deregulated. That just creates chaos.
Right.
I'm not sure that I can actually follow or agree with your argument, but I will say this as a member of the reading public and writing journalist, that there, something's been missing in the international economic system, and that is new instruments have come along, these mortgage-backed securities that are opaque, whose contents are not known or knowable in an easy and an immediate way. And without transparency and the ability to value assets, you really can't have trade. And that's at the heart of the problem right now. So if a regulation is required to ensure and require transparency, that will have that'll be progress. And it seems to me that coming back to Daniel's point, it's very hard for the international community to actually act as one community because we don't have the political organization to do that. And even the EU does not. But on some of these basic points, there could be agreement, and transparency has got to be one of them.
Just a follow up to that. I think, and I speak of this as a writing journalist, I think people might want to think twice about continuing to write sophisticated financial instruments in this context. They might want to say not very good financial instruments or something like rather less euphemistic in front of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I think what the caller is suggesting, there has been a counterargument made that the regulation, that the overregulation that he's referring to in some ways refers to the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac situation, where if the government is requiring a certain number of mortgages to go to low-income people, that sets up a situation where some of those may be bad. That's that argument, but I'm not saying whether I agree with it or not. And certainly, as my colleagues have said, the opacity of these financial instruments, the unknowable value of them is probably most at the heart of what's affecting the international system, right?
Let's go to Martinsburg, West Virginia. Rowell, you're on the air.
Thank you, Ms. Diane. Thank you. I got two quick questions.
Sure.
One is Senator John McCain said that we're winning the war in Iraq. I want to know if that's true. And second one is, what's going to happen to these homeowners whose credit was good before got into these houses, and then because of what's going on, foreclosure, the credit got bad. What's going to happen?
Roy.
Just to deal with Iraq, there's a new national intelligence estimate on Iraq as well. Apparently it won't be published until after the elections. But it essentially tells us what we're already observing. The situation has improved on the ground. I think the New York Times has a very fine piece today just describing how the barriers are being taken down that had been surrounding many areas of Baghdad. But it's very fragile. So many things can go wrong. Much of it's in the hands of the Iraqi government. How will they handle, for example, the Sunnis who are now part of the Awakening, you know, an American-backed militia? So far, not very promising signs. The Iranians, in a sense, have been playing along and helpfully, I think, in discouraging Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. They could change positions. There are many, many elements that are right on the edge and could go the other way. So let's not celebrate victory. Let's just talk about progress.
To Dominic in Cleveland, Ohio, you're on the air.
Yes, well, this is sort of what the speaker just was referring to. But before, when they said, well, the surge will not work in Afghanistan, it's because really the surge was made up wasn't simply the 20,000 or 30,000 troops that were added. The surge started back in 2006 with the Sunni Awakening and the partnership that we had with with our enemy to fight our enemy, Al-Qaeda. And that is what really brought about the stability. The surge, as Michael Ware from CNN has said, is simply icing on the cake.
Daniel.
Well, I think it's very interesting. I mean, General Petraeus was at the Heritage Foundation this week, and he said that he was in favor of talking to enemies, both in Iraq, where he identify this as the decisive factor that you just described it as, and indeed in Afghanistan. Of course, when one's talking to one's enemies, talking about Afghanistan, it's which enemies? There is obviously enormous resistance towards talking to Al-Qaeda. There's a lot of talking about to the Taliban. But I would just say on Iraq, the key question is, people like General Petraeus don't talk about victory, and people on all sides now say the big issue is a political one. Is Maliki going to centralise government and make it effective, or is he going to make it more sectarian? That's a political issue. And more as the Iraq story goes on, it's more determined by factors on the ground, political actors on the ground, and in that sense, the US's contribution matters less than it did.
And here's an email from Doug in Fort Worth. What is the economic situation in Switzerland? I've not heard any news about this country in which banking has such a huge reputation. Should we all go over and get a Swiss account until this blows over? Scott?
I couldn't speak to Switzerland specifically, but we have been looking at the UBS Bank, which is based in Switzerland. And it's one of these great examples of how the EU may respond to that. Switzerland is not a member of the EU, and UBS has assets three times larger than the Swiss GDP. So, and that is a bank that has shown signs of trouble in recent months. What would happen if that bank started to falter? Who would intervene on that bank? But I couldn't speak to the Swiss economy particularly.
And to Natalie, in which Wichita Falls, Texas. You're on the air.
Hello. Another wonderful show, Ms. Stream. Thank you for taking
Thank
my call
you.
Here. I'll be quick about a comment and perhaps an open-ended question here. I'm finding it interesting that there's hardly been a mention about the war effort continuing in Iraq and how it may be coinciding with the global meltdown on all the financial markets. And could any of your panelists please tell me and your audience how the war effort in Iraq is continuing to be funded? My understanding last time was that these are all being funded on loans, especially from Saudi Arabia and China. and I'd be interested for some comments.
All right. Thanks for calling, Roy Gutman.
Well, it's being funded by supplementals to the defense budget. You know, the basic defense budget's now about $515 billion, and this is before we pay for either of the wars, and it's about another $170 billion that is going to pay for the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think Iraq is about three-quarters or four-fifths of that amount, in fact. Where does the money come from? Well, we borrow it. So in that sense, you're right. China and anybody else with a surplus who is buying treasury notes is, in a sense, is lending us the money for it. But we owe that money. This is really coming, and eventually taxpayers are going to have to pay it.
What a dreadful summary, and truthful, but dreadful. We are paying for this war with borrowed money. And is there, going to our caller's question, a connection between the global meltdown financially and the Iraq war?
Well, I just would actually say that the key point is that the US isn't just paying for this war with borrowed money. It's paying for an awful lot with borrowed money, both on a national scale and a personal scale. The real problem is not just that the mortgage sector was so troubled. The real problem is not just that people's credit cards are becoming increasingly hard to honor.
But the credit cards can't hold a candle to what we're paying monthly for this war.
I think there'd probably be more, actually, to be honest.
Do you think more?
I do. I think probably significantly more. If we're spending $10 billion a month
a
in
month.
Iraq. Yeah, credit card charges are significantly above.
Okay,
that.
But don't a good many people pay those credit cards off?
Yes, it's. I think the larger point is that there's so much money being borrowed, and there's so much less money, therefore, in that when we talk about credit freezing in banks, we're talking about this extensive borrowing that's been taking place, and debt, and now loans and credit cards and all of these things going into default. No one trusting each other anymore. Banks not lending to each other anymore, and so I think it goes to the wider fiscal question of borrowing money in general.
Daniel.
Yes, I would simply add to that that when we came out of the Great Depression, a large part of that was because of deficit spending, because the economy had been run on a relatively conservative way to date. That's one of the things that makes the predicament right now so difficult.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Granite City, Illinois. Hi there, Ed. You're on the air.
I had a further follow-up question about credit default swaps.
Sure.
If the key to these things was that they perform the same function as insurance, but they weren't called insurance, did this whole deal require the complicity of the regulators to accept the legal fiction that it was not really insurance? And then wasn't the purpose of these credit default swaps also to permit financial institutions to avoid the the requirement that they keep enough funds to cover their risks? I forget what that's called right now.
Scott.
Well, now that I've become an expert on credit default swap, I'll give a cop-out answer here, which is this is why there's hearings taking place on Capitol Hill right now over what exactly happened. Whether it required complicity of regulators, willful ignorance on the part of regulators, or they just fooled regulators, it's unclear. But clearly these credit default swaps gave extra value to securities that now appear worthless.
And finally, to Charlie in Bethesda, Maryland, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Thank you, Diane, for your show. I have a quick comment and a question. Since you have always have international people on your panel, the question is, in terms of percentage, how much of a percentage change does the American government need to make to change its policies to do better in the world than we've been doing on And the comment is that if you saw the debate the other night, at the very end of the debate, McCain actually refused to shake hands with Obama. Obama stepped over to him to shake hands, and he pushed his wife in front of him, and Obama ended up shaking hands with his wife.
Okay, that was a little unclear. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yes, to be honest, I think McCain and Obama shook hands straight after the debate was concluded, but there was a problem with the camera shot right then, but it's fairly clear that they shook hands immediately after it ended.
I'm glad you cleared that up.
In terms of how much a percentage change the U.S. has to make, well, it's clear that the next president is going to try and make a virtue of the fact that he's going to follow George W. Bush, who was so controversial in much of the rest of the world. George W. Bush has made an effort, I think, to talk more with his European allies in particular, and also with China on issues like North Korea. The next president, I think, is going to try and do that in a much more dramatic way, so that he can have a little bit more of popular support across the world when he's going to be going and asking for help on things like Afghanistan.
Daniel Dombey, U.S. diplomatic correspondent for the Financial Times. Scott Wilson, he's foreign editor of the Washington Post. And Roy Gutman of McClatchy News, he's author of How We Missed the Story, Osama Bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. Thank you all so much.
Thanks, Leo.
Have a great weekend, all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.